Want to thank our sponsors, Arias Medical Staff, and you can find out more information about how you can get a job anywhere in the U.S. doing the thing you want to do, which is this physical therapy thing, with Arias. A-U-R-E-U-S medical.com. And one common misconception that I want to get out of the way right away, it doesn't cost you anything. Yeah, they're not trying to get money out of you and then find you a job. They're just sitting there with a bunch of jobs, and you're sitting there wanting to go to different places and travel around and be a PT. Match made in heaven. Arias is the leader. They'll get it done for you. A-U-R-E-U-S medical.com. The first round is on Owen's Recovery Science. Owen's Recovery Science is a single source
for PTs,
OTs,
ATCs,
DCs,
and other medical professionals
seeking certification
in personalized blood flow restriction rehabilitation training. Find out more and get certified
at owensrecoveryscience.com.
Had the pleasure of talking to Doug Kachijian. Doug is a physical therapist, but before he went into PT, he was a U.S. Air Force pararescueman. We talked about his practice, Resilient PT, in New York City, and what he transferred over from his pararescueman days and training to his PT practice now.
The best conversations happen at happy hour.
Come on.
Welcome to ours. This is the PT Pinecast.
Gotta go hard or go home.
Here's your host, physical therapist Jimmy McKay.
Today's guest is a physical therapist and co-founder of Resilient Performance Physical Therapy. He specializes in bridging the gap between acute rehabilitation and elite human performance. His clientele includes athletes and operators from the MLB, NBA, MMA, X Games, Winter and Summer Olympics, NCAA, Major League Lacrosse, U.S. Weightlifting, Military Special Operations Forces, and those with a history of chronic pain and extensive surgical backgrounds. Gotta reload the lungs there. Here we go. He also advises organizations about medical and performance staffing, system development, and injury risk mitigation strategies. And before becoming a physical therapist, he was a pararescueman in the U.S. Air Force, where he was deployed throughout the world to help provide technical rescue capability and emergency medical care to U.S. and allied forces. He's a nationally certified paramedic with advanced training in emergency, trauma, and wilderness medicine. And in 2015, he was selected as one of the U.S. Air Force's 12 Outstanding Airmen of the Year. On the show, Doug Kachijian. Doug, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on, Jimmy. Really appreciate it.
That is a hell of an intro, man. That is all over. I mean, we're looking at sports. We're looking at acute. We're looking at really, really acute in terms of paramedic. I got to ask, because I said this on a program, episode 100, I had a professor interview me, and she said, what would you have tried to do when you left radio, and if you didn't get into PT school, what would you have done? And my answer was, I wanted to be a PJ, and I just heard about it. I'd seen some of the stuff they have on like the Discovery Channel, and I would just sat there just awestruck at some of the stuff that PJs did in their jobs, but then what they had to do to get there. How'd you land there?
Well, it's funny to hear you say that, because most people have no idea what a PJ is. It's a little bit less well known than some of the other special operations type jobs, like SEALs and Rangers and even the Army Special Forces. So I guess, long story short, when I was an undergrad, I was actually pre-med, thought I wanted to go to med school. And you know, you're like 21 years old, so you really don't know exactly what you want to do. You think you have an idea.
Right.
I graduated undergrad in 2002. So in the fall of 2001 was September 11th. I'm not trying to make it like the day after September 11th, I wanted to join the military. But what happened after September 11th was there was a lot of publicity about the military, because you know, once Afghanistan kicked off, there was a lot of coverage. And I saw a documentary about pararescuemen or PJs, and it really piqued my interest, because at the time I wanted to do something in medicine. And even back then I knew I wanted to do something in sports medicine, but I'd always been intrigued by the special operations community, and particularly the selection process, just because I lived a pretty easy life. And you always, like, there's no like real sort of ancient cultures. There was always like a rite of passage that people went through, and we don't really have that kind of thing. So that idea really resonated with me. I'd always been intrigued, like I said, in some of those special operations type jobs, but ultimately the sort of the process of being, of the selection appealed to me more than the job itself. Whereas with pararescue, there was much more of a medical and a rescue emphasis. So it sort of combined my passion for medicine with physical activity and just wanting to challenge myself. And all those things kind of came together. The more that I learned and researched the job, the more intrigued I became. to the point that I withdrew my medical school applications and much to my parents' dismay, enlisted in the military. And I mean, in a way, everything worked out really well because it was an awesome experience. I mean, just got to work with some incredible people, learned a lot about myself. And ultimately, I didn't go to medical school, which I think now, knowing what I know now, I'm much happier for that. But it just gave me a lot more perspective on what I wanted to do down the road because there's a lot of medical training in the pararescue pipeline. I spent a lot of time in hospitals and emergency rooms. I realized that, you know, even in sports medicine, my sort of interest was more in the preventative side of things and having a longer term relationship with a patient and not kind of putting out fires. We do a little bit of that in PT, but I was more interested in the performance end. And just from some of the things that I did as a PJ, there's obviously a huge performance emphasis with some of the technical skills that we have to do. So everything kind of worked out. And I mean, all the life experiences that I've had have kind of complemented one another. But I think going through that PJ process gave me much more perspective on what it is that I ultimately want to do.
We must have saw the same documentary or something similar, but I mean, essentially, you know, a pararescueman or a PJ, I mean, you're a paramedic that jumps out of airplanes with parachutes. There's no ambulance. You're jumping out of an airplane into, you know, hostile environments, whether that be under fire, whether that be in the ocean. I mean, that's serious.
That was one of the cool things that was really, that I learned a lot from was the PJ pipeline. I mean, they only have so much time. They've got to train you in so many different disciplines. So ultimately, the objective is to get to a patient or a survivor and be able to extract that patient from a difficult situation and then medically stabilize that person. So there's a huge amount of medical training that goes into it. But on top of that, you have to, like you said, parachute, be able to scuba dive, learn technical rescue things like rope rescue and even the tactical piece like patrolling and marksmanship and just some small unit tactics. And you only have 18 months of actual training to accomplish all those objectives. And from a medical standpoint, I mean, it's I don't want to compare it to the civilian environment because it's totally different. But I mean, we had the autonomy to do things like chest tubes and surgical airways. And we're providing narcotics through intraosseous and intravenous devices, you know, doing blood transfusions in the field. Our formal medical training, I mean, the medical training lasted throughout our careers, but the formal medical training initially was like 6 to 8 months, which, you know, and we're doing things that in some cases, like only a PA or a physician would be able to do in the civilian world. And I think what I learned was if you're really focused on just the learning objectives and preparing people for what they have to do, I think that a lot of times in academia, they kind of mystify things and make them harder than they have to be. And every academic program, whether it's physical therapy school or medical school, has these rite of passages where you memorize all this information and you brain dump it after the test. And really like where you learn, it still falls back on the apprenticeship model where if you're a physician, you're relying on your residency or your fellowship. As a PT, you're relying on your internships. So you definitely need some kind of a theoretical basis in the classroom so that you actually understand what it is you're doing and why.
Right.
But what the military taught me was that theoretical basis doesn't have to be as sort of complex as people make it. And you really like learn, all right, what's the bottom line? What do I have to do? And there's no false confidence. It's not like a hospital where you've got a team of people to help you. I mean, it's really on you to do certain things. And I'm not trying to act like, again, that we're more trained than what a civilian paramedic would be. It's just a different environment. But the environment there dictates the training be much more streamlined. And when you have those deadlines, I think you can trim a lot of the fat, which was really interesting. And then transferring from that environment to a more academic environment, it kind of just shaped how I look at learning and performance and those kind of things.
I didn't realize that. I saw the list of things that you have to go through, essentially the syllabus to be a pararescueman. I didn't realize it was 18 months because, I mean, I'm looking at 3 years of PT school. I know I had a lot of information and you're telling me you're doing emergency medicine. By the way, we're going to teach you how to jump at airplanes into hostile environments and swim and navigate in the wilderness. And by the way, it's in 18 months and get your stuff together. And oh yeah, by the way, 8 out of 10 of you aren't going to make it.
Right. It's 18 months of actual training. So that's assuming that like all the different schools line up perfectly, which is never the case. So 18 months is like perfect scenario, which never happens. So it's usually between 2 and 3 years.
If you want to reach out and find out more about Doug, you can check out Resilient PT.com. That's the website. On Twitter at ResilientPPT. And I like the definition right there at the top: the capacity to withstand stress and hardship, able to recover readily and adaptable. I mean, just looking at the parallels from being a pararescueman, yes, you want to be able to do that because you're going to be called upon to do amazing feats of physical acts, and you want your patients to be able to just do going to work and picking up their kids. You want them to be resilient. I think that's a great word for a physical therapy clinic, a great name for a physical therapy clinic, because that's what we ultimately, right, want our patients and the public to be.
Yeah, you know, resilient, obviously, it's context specific, right? So sort of the degree of resiliency that's required for a pararescueman is much different than what might be required for someone who's recovering from a stroke or just a typical like weekend warrior. I think this is changing because I think PTs are becoming a little bit more informed about just some of the mechanism of injury and what it is that we're actually doing with people. But we're still relying on that patho-anatomical model where we're diagnosing these very sort of tangible type things, which I don't think actually are occurring in the clinic. For the most part, waiting till people don't hurt anymore and are saying, okay, like you're better. And I mean, if we were really fixing pathology or claiming to treat pathology, that's kind of outside of our scope of practice anyway. I mean, we're not changing anatomy. Mm-hmm. All we're really doing is we're changing motor control in the short term, and then maybe we're adding fitness on top of that in the form of, you know, adding load or fatigue or speed of movement, and then we're trying to introduce some tactical complexity to that. And if you're working with an athlete, that's different than if you're working from someone who's trying to pick up groceries. But ultimately, we're trying to create an adaptable human being. If you overly pathologize people, you forget that you're trying to prepare them for something and not just get them to sort of a normative level of physical function, but to get them to exceed that and give them a little bit of a buffer. Most people are going to regress to the mean and get better over time. And I think that sometimes as a profession, we kind of underdeliver and we forget about the idea that we're trying to make people, give people the ability to withstand stress. And so if we kind of look outside the clinical lens and more into even a performance lens, I think that's going to help us even be better as clinicians. Where it gets tricky is, especially if you're in an insurance-based model, insurance companies aren't going to reimburse to give somebody more than is considered the norm. And on top of that, I mean, you have to value people's time and money because they're still paying a copay in an insurance model. I'm all out of network. But even on top of that, even if money was not an issue, I mean, you can't expect people to come in 1 to 3 days a week indefinitely. It's kind of like, I tell this to my patients, I say, I want to have you here as little as possible. If the dentist told me you've got to come in 3 times for a week for 8 weeks outside of like a post-surgery scenario, I'd tell that person, you're out of your mind. Like, tell me what I can do at home, which is why education is a huge piece. And we're trying to kind of create some online educational resources because we can't keep telling people to come in. But if we can make things a little bit more scalable and create some learning platforms where people want to learn more about how to remain sort of adaptable and resilient. I don't know if they need to necessarily do that in the clinic while they're supervised. I think there are ways to do that where you can save people time and prevent them from having to come in. And I think that's mm-hmm. where ultimately the profession and even healthcare as a whole needs to go, because allowing or forcing more people to have skin in the game versus this dependency model, because the 3 times a week for 8 weeks thing creates dependency. And I don't even know if you're in that model, if you're a clinician, you have the incentive to discharge somebody very quickly because you know the insurance company is going to reimburse you for those 24 visits. But and it's very easy to get biased at looking at things through a clinical lens, what's best for us. But we're also consumers of healthcare. And I don't know if as a consumer of healthcare, that's the best thing even as a taxpayer, because it's really expensive too. So it's really interesting. I think healthcare is changing. And I think that PT could play a huge role in that dynamic healthcare environment. But things need to change both within our profession and in other professions too, because I don't think that what we're doing now is sustainable. It's too much of a dependency model.
Your insight is very, very unique because you took a military background, a para jumper, and you kind of brought them together, and now you're in PT. How do we learn from other professions, since being a PJ is kind of being a hybrid of a bunch of different things and putting it into practice? How do we learn from other professions to become a better PT or a better PT profession?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And obviously, I'm biased because I came from a job in the military where I was a generalist. And my bias is that I think that there's too much specialization now that's going on, particularly in medicine. So if we're talking about a surgeon, like I want to go to the knee surgeon who's done 10,000 ACL surgeries, not the general surgeon. So if we're talking about a particular skill that involves a high amount of risk, like a surgical procedure, you want to see a specialist. Now, in pararescue, to be fair, I don't think that I had as much clinical experience as somebody who worked in the ICU full-time. I was not as good a parachutist as a professional skydiver. I wasn't as good a diver as a commercial diver. I wasn't as good a mountaineer as a professional mountain guide. I knew just enough to be able to get to a patient and then stabilize the patient, but I was never a specialist in any of those things. And sometimes that has some limitations. But I think in healthcare, a lot of times the problem is that we're not connecting the dots as well. And because we're looking at things through a very specialized lens, ultimately we're missing some connections. So if we're talking about even an outpatient sports PT, like let's say you get a high school athlete who's recovering from an ACL tear. I mean, ultimately, you almost have to have the knowledge of a track and field coach to adequately prepare that person and give that person that physiological buffer that's necessary to withstand the stress of sport. Because like in football, even at the high school level, you're sprinting at a maximal velocity, you're changing direction in a very dynamic and chaotic environment. And if all you're saying is, well, you have full range of motion in your knee, your manual muscle testing is good, and that now you're relying on, say, like the high school football coach to prepare that person for football, you're assuming that high school football coach has the knowledge of sprint biomechanics and sprint preparation and some of the things that like we're actually supposed to be responsible for. So the specialization model, it works if you have access to all the different specialized pieces of knowledge, which maybe you might have like in a pro sports environment, but most of us don't work in that environment. Even if you had that, like seamless communication, and you had all the pieces to connect those dots, there's still the communication piece where you know people can still slip through the cracks. So I'm not saying that everyone needs to do everybody else's job, but I think that there's a lot of arbitrary boundaries and distinctions between jobs, whether it's like a physical therapist and an athletic trainer, a physical therapist and a physiatrist, physical therapist and a strength and conditioning coach. And a lot of times those boundaries aren't really practical. They're driven more by political and financial incentives. And I get it, you know, PT is becoming this like autonomous profession. We want to have direct access. So PTs and every other profession needs to brand themselves as if they're unique. But the problem is when you brand yourself as if you're unique, so like if we're fighting over who can do dry needling and manipulation, those are just tools. They aren't really, in the grand scheme of things, that important in isolation. But if we're focusing on these tools and these specialized interventions, we're missing the thought process. And then you're really not adaptable as a profession and an organization because you're so reliant on these tools and you're trying to make yourself unique. In an ideal world, there would be more communication, there'd be more seamlessness between professions. And there's a lot of professional redundancy because if I was a patient, right, like I wouldn't really know. I don't think that PT has done a great job of marketing itself or branding itself as to what makes it unique. I wouldn't, if I wasn't a PT, really know why I should go to a PT versus a chiropractor or an athletic trainer or even a really good like fitness person. If we're just using knowledge as sort of the basis for when to go to someone, I mean, really like any one of those professions could do a pretty decent job with someone who's in pain, minus like a post-surgical scenario where you're not egregiously violating scope of practice. But I think that a lot of times the political infighting that takes place comes at the expense of the patient when there's too much redundancy and it's not driven by the right incentives, which is getting people better. It's driven by, all right, like how do we increase our market share? And I'm a pragmatist. I get that that's important, but I think it's coming at a clinical cost.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of fiefdoms. There's a bunch of my kung fu is better than your kung fu and only my kung fu will solve your problems. That other profession, oh, they're no good whatsoever. And that doesn't allow you to learn. As we started this, you know, conversation off, doesn't allow you to learn from other professions and what they might have figured out. And how are you supposed to grow if you're just listening to what's in your own camp?
Yeah. And I think that like ultimately the patient should have the choice. And it would seem that like right now the patient actually, so I talk about redundancy. It seems like I'm saying that the patient has too many options, but those options aren't real options because even PT as a profession is kind of held back from what it wants to do because people who have more established medical lobbies don't give us the ability to do what it is that we really want to do. And to be fair, like I've received emails from our governing body where they're like, hey, athletic trainers want to have more autonomy in New York. Like, here's who you should contact to prevent that from happening. So everyone's doing it to everybody else. And what ultimately happens is whoever kind of has the deeper pockets is trying to subjugate everybody else. So even though I'm saying there's redundancy, we don't actually have real choice because I think that healthcare is overly regulated. I think knowledge should be the limiting factor. And there's kind of like this facade of public safety. So I remember professional development course and I was talking about you know, autonomy for physical therapists and a children advertisement that was paid for by an orthopedic group. I forgot what state it was, but it basically said something like, do you want to go to a physical therapist without a referral? Get your back pain undiagnosed because you had a malignant tumor. And sort of the implication is that there's this like epidemic of undiagnosed cancers that are happening and these fatalities as a result of those undiagnosed cancers because PTs have more direct access. I don't know if there's any data to suggest that that's happening. And it's the same thing with, you know, dry needling is a controversial topic because people argue about evidence and those kind of things. But let's just assume that it was a good thing, whatever that means. And now it's like, well, certain professions shouldn't do dry needling because everyone's going to get a pneumothorax. And again, we're kind of like, we're making these procedures more mystical than they have to be. And you could argue that the only reason some professions maybe have a higher success rate in diagnosing, say, a tumor in the back is because their scope of practice allows them to prescribe imaging. So, and most of the time, the imaging is overly prescribed. So if you're giving everyone who has back pain an MRI or an X-ray, you're going to catch those cancerous tumors. But is it because those professions have better clinical judgment? And based on their subjective history, they're saying, well, I think that your back actually doesn't hurt because of a movement issue. It's because you have a tumor. Again, I don't know if that's a real thing, but there is this facade of public safety where, and we're guilty of it too as PTs, where if like a fitness trainer is massaging somebody's calf with a stick, we're like, that person's doing soft tissue work. They're going to hurt someone. It's like, I don't know if that's really like an unsafe thing. Again, knowledge should be the filter. And there need to be boundaries between professions that are based on skill set and things that can actually have the potential for harm. But I think a lot of this stuff is overly politicized. So to your point, we need to redraw the boundaries between professions because there needs to be more cooperation, I think, less politicizing of some of these boundaries.
And we're looking at viewpoints and extremes, and I hate the term, but yes, it comes up a lot, fear-mongering, you know, oh my gosh, do you want to go to a PT? What if you had brain cancer? But now we also get into extreme viewpoints within our own profession. You know, you can just look at, you know, PT and what we do within this profession, and you've got some extreme viewpoints in terms of, you know, Adam Meekins is big and say manual therapy sucks, it does nothing. You got the other way, you know, saying that, you know, manual therapy can cure GI issues and help facilitate pregnancy. Especially as a new grad, we talked before we hit record. I mean, I graduated a year ago. I'm sitting here and I'm imagining other people. I don't care if you're a new grad, a student, or you've been a PT for a while. It's got to get it's confusing. It just feels like you're in a blizzard full of information. You don't know which way's up.
Yeah, and I think it's emblematic of a trend that transcends PT. People are sort of gravitating towards the extremes, and I think that the extremes provide comfort because if you're an extremist, you don't actually have to think. You don't have to draw all these boundaries. You don't have to have a nuanced perspective on things.
That's a good point.
In the political world, people are going further left or further right, not towards the middle. And what that allows you to do is to sort of create an enemy where, like, you don't have to take responsibility for anything you do. You can just blame someone or something else. And so manual therapy is sort of a great microcosm for this phenomenon. Like, I don't think manual therapy is a very difficult issue conceptually at all. Like you said, you've got the extremists who say manual therapy disempowers patients, it turns them into these helpless wrecks, and it's kind of like giving someone a drug, right? Like if you give someone aspirin, they're going to end up like in a parking lot on bath salts, you know? and I think that's very intellectually dishonest. And the flip side of that, you have people who are saying that manual therapy is breaking up scar tissue and it's doing all these things and it's the cure-all for everything. And again, it's somewhere in the middle. I think we have to draw more sort of intellectually honest boundaries. And I think where people, especially PTs, get hung up is I think that theoretical explanations are very important, especially when it comes to manual therapy. Like, we don't actually know from a theoretical standpoint what it's exactly doing. So if we're going to use it, and I think this is where some of like the anti-manual therapy people can become overly dogmatic and puritanical, they'll say things like, well, we don't have any evidence to suggest that manual therapy provides any specific effect. In other words, that it's like working on a tissue or a histological or very localized level. That's probably working at a more central or neurophysiological level. Even if that's true, that's not a reason not to do it. It's just a reason not to tell somebody,
right,
hey, I'm going to do this technique. I'm not going to claim to know what it's doing, or I'm not going to say something that I don't know to be true. So if you're going to do a manual therapy technique, you could say, look, my ultimate goal is to make you self-sufficient and not need this manual therapy. But if I can do this technique that I'm not 100% sure how it works It's probably not physically changing the property of your tissue, but it might provide some transient pain relief. And that transient pain relief might allow you to do something that you've had trouble doing. Movement is ultimately what we're striving for. I think we should strive as a profession to be theoretically robust. But when it comes to communicating with a patient, we don't need to tell them that we're doing a technique and that it's reducing cortical smudging and it's decreasing ion channel sensitivity or whatever we think that manual therapy or anything that alters pain perception is doing. I think we could use more simplistic metaphors that don't perpetuate mistruths. I think that sometimes we can be a little bit too much like comic book guy from The Simpsons, where we're overly intellectual, and because we're trying to establish ourselves as an autonomous profession, we have a little bit of a chip on our shoulder, and we overly fixate on these theoretical mechanisms. And I think that internally we have to have those conversations, but when it comes to talking to the patient, I think that we can lose patience if we don't want to do something like manual therapy, if we think that we're above it because it has a non-specific effect. Because when we're talking about the body and medicine, it's a complex system. I think it's probably safe to say that even manual therapy is working on a local level. We just don't know exactly how it's doing that yet. And it's also working on a more global level. Like, nothing is ever working on a local level separate from a global level. It's always doing all of those things. We just don't know how to measure it or explain it yet. I think we should strive for intellectual rigor in our profession, but we should also try to speak to the patient in a language that he or she could understand.
Right. Just don't sell snake oil. As you mentioned too, and we alluded to earlier, by the time someone actually figures out which healthcare provider to navigate through to go see, they've been having that issue, whatever it be, pain or dysfunction. It's been a while. So we want to try something, you know, and get them moving as quickly as possible, because we know them not moving is pretty detrimental.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that, like, the evidence-based movement, to a degree, it's kind of like rhetorical, because why would you do something for which there's no evidence? And everyone thinks that what they're doing has evidence, even if it's not empirical or like from an RCT. So, like, everyone thinks that what they're doing has some kind of a sound theoretical or empirical basis. It's like more who's the arbiter of what constitutes good evidence. And I think that overall, even sort of relying on some of these controlled trials to validate what we do, I think that's a good thing, and it needs to continue. Sure. But even if we do that and we rely on the controlled trials, in order for those trials to have any kind of to be theoretically sound, you have to isolate or control for the effects of every variable but for the one that you're trying to study. Well, you can do it in a controlled trial, but then you're taking all these controlled trials where it totally eliminates the impact of context. You have to connect these dots. Even if you're relying on these controlled trials, you still have to tinker. And, like, no matter, I don't care, even the people who go on social media and talk about how evidence-based they are and how informed they are about the literature, I don't like that word either, but that's what, like, you know, literature as if it's like the canon. They still have to tinker too, because the controlled trials don't tell you exactly what to do. Now, I think they can tell you what not to do. There are certain things that have very poor evidence or very poor data to support them, and we shouldn't keep doing those things, but it can become very puritanical, and this PubMed Olympics phenomenon where some of these PT discussions are very predictable, where it's like, it'll be like a Facebook group and someone will be like, hey, I'm thinking about taking this Con Ed course. Like, what did you guys think of it? And then it'll turn into the soapbox where it's like the people who are claiming that this Con Ed course is the cure-all for everything, and they'll perpetuate some theoretically flawed explanations for whatever that technique is. And then you'll have the research purists who are like, there's absolutely zero evidence to support it. Ultimately, everyone's tinkering. It's trial and error. The controlled trials need to guide what we're doing, but there's still a hole there. If we're talking about complexity, people even talk about the placebo effect in a derogatory manner. I think that we need to exploit the placebo effect, not to the point that we're lying to people, but every aspect of your patient interaction can shape outcomes, even the things that aren't quote-unquote clinical or like an intervention. And if we're talking about complexity, everything is clinical and everything's an intervention, but from how you talk to the person to how the room is lighted, all these things, and as long as you're honest with that person, we should exploit every variable at our disposal to try to get a better outcome. And again, we should strive for honesty, but the idea that something that totally eliminates context, when context is everything in the clinical environment, eliminating context doesn't totally inform us about what is best practice. Determining what is best practice involves a lot of tinkering. The only way to resolve it is to have conversations amongst other professionals, because, like, we have the luxury of having these conversations and these problems, but human beings are pretty good at solving much more pressing problems throughout history, like food procurement, how to protect themselves from predators, how to build shelters. We built cities. I mean, like, human beings are capable of some pretty amazing things, and they did those things by tinkering and having conversations, sometimes heated conversations, but, like, PT is not any different. Like, we're going to have to do the same thing to advance the profession, but those conversations are a lot more difficult to have when people gravitate towards these extremes, and they try to blame other people, and they point fingers. They resort to some of these emotional arguments. So right. I think heated conversations are good, but some of the conversations within our profession that I've witnessed don't give me a lot of hope, because people dance around, like, what are the real boundaries? And instead of just trying to establish, all right, what are good boundaries in these complex systems, they gravitate towards the extremes, and then nothing really gets done.
Right. I mean, people are arguing to be right. They're arguing sometimes to win an argument. Do you want to get it right, or do you want to be right? You know, the question was, I'm looking to take this, you know, Khan Ed course. What was your experience? It wasn't, can you debunk everything within the syllabus of this Khan Ed course? I'm looking to take a course. I'm looking at the ultimate goal, really, is I'm trying to get smarter somehow. You might take a course and not agree with anything, but you took the course.
Yeah. And I've been in some of these discussions where I've been like, yeah, you know, I took the course. I thought it was valuable. I don't agree with everything that they propose theoretically. And then people would come in and say, well, they're perpetuating some things that are theoretically flawed. So therefore, nothing that you learn in that course is valuable. And, like, no one has these theoretical explanations totally nailed. But this idea that a Khan Ed course has to have 100%, has to be 100% theoretically airtight to be provide clinical utility, I think is intellectually very dishonest. I don't think any course meets that standard. I think that transparency is really important. And even though people think that case studies aren't important or aren't useful because they're not as good as, say, an RCT, I think case studies are really important, because it's like, I want to know why you did what you did. And if someone's able to have that conversation and be transparent without being attacked, I think we can learn a lot from case studies. But sometimes a lot of the people who are, they're very critical of what everybody else does. When you say, okay, well, like, all right, what would you do for this person? And I'm not here to judge you. I want to know legitimately, like, what did you see in your evaluation? Based on that evaluation, what interventions did you use? That's when people are very quiet. And it's because when you show people what you do, it makes you vulnerable. But that's the only way to make the profession better, because we have to have these conversations and draw these boundaries, and it requires transparency. So I respect people who actually, like, we'll show a case study on YouTube or on the internet, especially within our profession. It's only going to hurt you. It's not going to help you. You're going to get attacked. And I'm not trying to make it like physical therapy is the only profession that has these issues internally. It's just the one that I pay the most attention to. It's happening everywhere, and it's happening on a much more important level, like I said, in the political realm. But we're having a PT conversation, so all we can really focus on is how to make this profession better. But transparency is huge. We have to make ourselves vulnerable, and we can be critical of people without destroying everything that they do. Again, this transcends PT. Every profession should be having these same sort of dialogues internally.
Yeah, I like it. Going to take a quick break. Before we do, I know you've been around the country, been around the world. Our sponsors, Arias Medical Staffing, helping get PTs and PTAs jobs all over the U.S. The question was, how many years of experience do you have to find an assignment, a travel assignment with Arias? It's a trick question. Arias works with PTs and PTAs of all experience levels, new grads to seasoned PTs and PTAs. So even if you're a student right now and you're looking forward to graduating and you want to do PT anywhere in the U.S., talk to them. AriasMedical.com. That's AureusMedical.com. Or give them a call at their 800 number to talk to a recruiter that just works with you, not an operator, a recruiter. 1-800-340-2619. That's 1-800-340-2619. You can go anywhere in the U.S. and find a job to do this thing that we're talking about here today with Doug, that is PT. And if you like where you're working, if you have a travel assignment and want to stay there, Arias can do that too. Travel and permanent assignments with full-time placement for physical therapists and PTAs. Again, that website, AureusMedical.com, AureusMedical.com. We're going to get to three questions when we come back with Doug. We're going to talk about his podcast and why he likes doing it. And we're going to get into what's coming up down the line for Resilient Performance PT in New York City. On the way with Doug Kachigian on PT Podcast.
Making your commute to clinic enjoyable since 2015.
What is it?
This is the PT Pinecast.
The PT Pinecast is powered by Smart Tools, the next generation of instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization. The fastest-growing approach to IASTM is Smart Tools. From high-quality, American-made tools. Smart Tools. Find them online at smarttoolsplus.com. The Physical Therapy Outcomes Registry.
Brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.
It uses data from the profession
for the profession
to help you elevate your patient care, visualize your value, and define your future. The Outcomes Registry collects and aggregates electronic health record data from practices to help physical therapists make well-informed clinical decisions and track clinical outcomes against nationwide averages. By joining the registry, you'll gain a critical tool to demonstrate the value of physical therapy. It's easy. It's fast. It's the future. Find out more online now at ptoutcomes.com.
That's ptoutcomes.com.
The Physical Therapy Outcomes Registry.
Brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.
Let's give a nice, warm welcome to...
We're back. It's so great to see you. Let's get back to the show now. Back on PT Pinecast with Doug Kachigian of Resilient Performance PT. Check him out online, resilientperformancept.com, and on Twitter as well. You can find him at ResilientPPT. Got a blog. They got a podcast. You got all over, man. You got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean, definitely keeps me busy.
Not just running your own clinic, not just the outside of that, of course.
Right, and that's the tricky part is... You know, I'm still relatively new as a clinician. I want to be as competent a clinician as I can. How do you simultaneously become a better craftsman? But I'm also running a business. And so I'm trying to put out more information. And you mentioned off the air, like, why do you do a podcast? I mean, I'll be honest. And I think everyone does a podcast for the most part because you're trying to expose people to what it is that you're doing. And I can't even say in any kind of a tangible sense that like doing a podcast has resulted in more business. But I think the reason that I continue to do it is because I enjoy the conversations that we're having right now. And that's kind of the goal of the podcast originally was kind of, I thought it was going to be more PT and performance centric, but then I got kind of bored with that. And now it's really more about like global thinking and complexity and how to navigate a world with so much uncertainty and really more about learning from other professions. Cause I think ultimately we're trying to solve the same problems. And selfishly, I'm really doing it for myself because I get to talk to interesting people.
Oh, yeah.
Learn from them, and they're much more apt to give you their time if you're broadcasting their message to, to the world. So
I get to geek out. You know, like I said, you know, if I wasn't going to PT, I admired, you know, Parareskimen, and all of a sudden this came up, and I was like, oh yeah, this dude did what I would have thought would have been like the coolest job in the world. So you'd get to have these conversations, and the benefit is I didn't say, hey Doug, I want to be selfish, let me have a beer with you real quick in New York City, and then you can tell me some secrets. I said, hey, let's have a conversation, then we'll share it. Everybody wins from a podcast. It's free. It spreads all over the place, as we both know, and you get some killer conversations about some stuff that you might not have even thought about. Like you said, you thought it was going to be training and strength and conditioning specific, and it's gotten to stuff, but it's never deviated from what you wanted because you wanted good conversation.
Right, totally.
Resilient Performance Podcast is where you can find it on iTunes. And again, that website, Resilient Performance PT, you can find a link to the podcast. Wanted to make sure I got into three questions with you, powered by our friends from ariusmedical.com. Where in the U.S., because you're in Manhattan, man. I mean, I'm a New Yorker, greatest city in the world, but where would you go in the U.S. outside of New York to be a PT if you could go for a 13-week assignment? What would you want to explore?
The answer to that question would depend on the season. I would say if it was like if it was the winter, probably somewhere like Jackson Hole, where I could be near the mountains, or you know, maybe somewhere in the Rockies or even like Utah. And then if it was, you know, the warmer months, maybe somewhere like San Diego or somewhere that has some wind, so I could do some kiteboarding and be near a beach. But I don't think you can go wrong with Southern California. But even in the summer, I mean, Long Island is pretty cool in the summer too, but the answer to either of those questions would be not New York City. So I think I can agree on that. Yeah.
I like that very much. All right. What's something that you've read recently that really inspired you?
Okay. So probably two things. So doing the podcast, I mean, you know, this, like, you have to kind of research your guests. So I've had to read a lot of books and blogs just so I'm better prepared to ask them the right questions. So I had somebody on a couple months ago named Russ Roberts. He's an economist from Stanford, and he wrote an article called "What Do Economists Actually Know?" And it's not really an article about economics per se, but it's really about sort of intellectual humility and what are the limitations of data and mathematical modeling, and how, because this happens in PT too, where if we're looking at like an RCT, for example, citing an RCT doesn't mean that we actually know what's going on. It's just information. A lot of the things that we do in any profession are based on some assumptions. We have to make some deductive leaps. Where did our assumptions come from? And then if we're creating a clinical or like an economic model, like these assumptions are based on other assumptions, which are based on other assumptions. When you get to the end product, it's like you have this thing where it's like, okay, if you're talking about an economic policy, if we do X thing, it's going to increase GDP by Y percent. And so the argument that Russ makes is no one can actually say that with any degree of certainty. So it's really about how to embrace uncertainty, and not to say that like economists don't matter or that PTs don't matter, but really more, or how can these professions use that expertise or apply that expertise more responsibly without claiming to do things that we don't know with any degree of truth. So I think that was a big thing that's really influenced how I think when I'm getting into these complex topics. And then I just read a book called Extreme Ownership. It was written by two Navy SEAL officers who actually were in charge of the like the Navy SEAL leadership development program. I was kind of late to the party on that, but and I thought it was going to be more a book about like these guys pounding their chests and talking about like how cool they are. But it was much different than what I thought. It's really a book about personal and organizational accountability, and I think that from a leadership standpoint, a professional development standpoint, accountability is a huge thing. And we're seeing it again in the political sphere where nobody wants to take accountability for everything. They're always blaming other people, other parties, pointing fingers. And it's really about kind of controlling what you can control, trying to shape your environment to do the best job you can. And if there are things that you can't control, but if you focus on the things that you can control and take ownership and accountability of what you're doing, that's really the best way to thrive as an individual and as an organization. So great book that one of the few books, like special operations type books, that I think is generalizable to other fields. So I'd highly recommend mm-hmm. that. And yeah. that's going to be a book where if we ever bring more people on to work with us, like it's going to be required reading even more than a physical therapy centric book.
Cool. Last question on three questions. Who's someone in the field of PT that the audience should know more about?
It's hard to narrow it down to one. So I'll give a couple. And these are people who I'm going to name only because they don't have huge social media profiles. Bill Hartman is one of them. He was my clinical instructor, or one of my clinical instructors in PT school. Wealth of information, and I wish he had more of a voice, but he's not really interested in promoting himself, so to the detriment of the rest of us. Josh Funk is a friend of mine in Maryland, outpatient physical therapist who's done a really great job of, he's only been in business for a couple of years and opened up multiple clinics. And he's done a great job of leveraging his community, which I think is something that we could all learn from. Those would be the guys where I would start.
Sounds good. Last topic I wanted to get into, since you're in the business of outpatient orthopedic physical therapy and the healthcare model, is that current outpatient PT, that healthcare model, sustainable? If not, what's going to happen? Look down the line.
Wow, that's a pretty involved question for the last one. I'll try to make it short. So I know you want to wrap it up. In a post-op scenario, yeah, somebody needs to come multiple days a week for at least a couple of weeks initially. But I think that we've applied the post-op model to sort of non-traumatic, non-acute cases. So for like non-specific low back pain, a runner who has just some anterior knee pain, I think that that sort of post-op model, which tends to pervade the rest of outpatient PT, is antiquated and not sustainable. I think, and this is just like healthcare in general, I think more people, clinicians and patients, need to have more skin in the game. Like where maybe down the road it's something like to an insurance company, if it's an insurance model, something like low back pain or knee pain is worth, say, $1,000. And whoever you want, if you're the patient, spend that $1,000, you can do it. But I think it's even bankrupting health insurance companies. And I don't know why they have incentive to, in a non-operative or non-post-operative case, to have their patients be seen 3 days a week for 8 weeks. So I think that if we're truly trying to create self-efficacy like we say that we are, we have to create educational platforms that patients can access from home to assume more responsibility. I think there is a place for hands-on care. We still need to show people how to execute movements the right way. So I'm not trying to replace clinicians, but I think that even as it is now, like the outpatient physical therapy is way too dependent on the clinician. So if there's ways that we can promote independence and self-efficacy, I think that's where the profession needs to go. And I think other professions are already creating too much of a dependency model. So if PTs are trying to differentiate themselves and make themselves unique, that's the way to do it, because time is the most precious commodity everybody has. If for the same condition, I can go to a PT and only have to go in for two visits and spend X amount of money versus going to a different profession, and that's going to take multiple visits a week for several weeks, I'm going to go where I can save more time, possibly even money. But I think time is the most precious thing.
Sure.
So I know that it sounds crazy, but the more that we can make ourselves redundant, I think the better the profession will be monetarily, as crazy as that sounds.
Yeah, as we move forward, everybody wants that healthcare 2.0, the preventative health model.
Yeah, we have to be way more proactive and less reactive, I think.
All right, every episode we record is a pint. Can't let you get out of here without doing a shot. Parting shot of wisdom.
This is the parting shot.
Powered by Optum, Optum offers weekend courses that are Monday morning applicable, utilizing approaches that make sense.
They promote excellence in hands-on treatment, exercise prescription, pain science, and clinical reasoning, offering a COMT,
as well as an APTA-accredited fellowship in orthopedic manual therapy, both online and in-person mentoring, with locations in Houston, Dallas, and Scottsdale, Arizona. Find out more online
at optumfellowship.com.
What's something you want to leave the audience with thinking about as they go forward after this episode?
It's an exciting profession with a lot of potential. But I think we're very far from reaching our potential. I think the way to do that is to have these difficult conversations respectfully, learn from different professions, and sort of recognize the arbitrary boundaries between professions, and also recognize that as much as we want to brand ourselves and make ourselves unique, we also have to recognize that from the consumer standpoint, what are the drawbacks of doing that? The more that the profession can focus on what's going to be best for the end user and not necessarily what's always best for PTs or the profession in the short term, I think that's kind of the way forward.
You can find more information about Doug and his clinic, resilientperformancept.com. His podcast is out on iTunes. It is the Resilient Performance Podcast, and follow him on Twitter, ResilientPPT. Looking forward to more stuff coming down the line. And now that I actually got my license yesterday. I'm officially a licensed physical therapist in the state of New York now that I've moved here. So looking to catch up in person sometime in the Big Apple.
Yeah, I mean, you got an open invitation to come by whenever you want.
Sounds great. Doug, appreciate your time and sharing some knowledge with us, and just love the story, man. And keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. Same to you.
Rocktape, more than just a tape company. Rocktape keeps athletes of all levels moving stronger, longer.
With the world's best kinesiology tape,
topical pain relief,
mobility equipment,
and protective gear.
And now physical therapists can get 20% off their first purchase right now at shop.rocktape.com.
Just use the code PTPINECAST at checkout to get 20% off.
That's shop.rocktape.com.
With the code PTPINECAST for killer savings of 20% off.
Rocktape, the world's best kinesiology tape.
The PT Pinecast is a product of PT Pinecast LLC.
It is hosted and produced by PT Pinecast CEO Jimmy McKay and CBO Sky Donovan from Marymount University.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it.
This has been another pour from the PT Pinecast.
The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that. We talk physical therapy, drink beer, and record it.
Oh, and we share it with you for free.
But instead of having you pay to hear our show, we just want you to
pay it forward.
Tell a PT friend about the show.
Share it on social media.
And click the subscribe button on iTunes or Google Play so you never miss an episode. And thanks for listening.
Go have another beer. We won't charge you.
This is the PT Pinecast.